Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon taking your phone calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, you'd like to talk about those, you have a different viewpoint from that of the host, we'd like to talk about that, this is a good place and time to do it. You've got a phone, I've got a phone number for you, and if you call that number, you can get on the air and we can talk about the question or the comment on your mind. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. One announcement for those living in Southern California. Once a month we have a meeting in Southern California on a Friday night. That's this Friday night. It's just going to be a Q&A, just like this show, and you're welcome to join us for that. If you're interested, the information can be found at our website, thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. At the announcements link, you'll find the information for this Friday night's gathering in Temecula. Okay, that went quick, didn't it? Let's go to the phones now and talk to first caller today is Tom from Monterey, California. Longtime caller.
Hey, Steve, how are you?
2 decades. You've been calling me for about 2 decades, Tom?
Uh-oh. I don't know if I'm connected.
Can't you hear me? Uh-oh, we better make sure that he can hear.
Steve, I don't hear you.
Okay, well, I can hear you. I think someone in the studio can fix that, hopefully. Testing, 1, 2. Tom, can you hear me? No, he cannot. Studio, can we do something about that? Hopefully. All right, well, listen, I'm going to put Tom back on hold.
I heard you click, but okay. Nobody's there.
Okay, Tom, I'm going to put you on hold. You can't hear me, I'm afraid. But with you on hold, we can come back to your call as soon as the studio lets me know that we have remedied the problem. Because if it's a problem for you, it'll probably be a problem for the other callers, too. It must be some kind of a switch on the console that's got to be thrown a different way. So in a moment, we'll come back and see if we can get your call, Tom. Anthony wrote to me a little while ago, and he asked a question I don't have really much I can say about, but he did ask I should address it. He said, what is your take on using the word supernatural in church from the pulpit? Some background. There is some ambivalence in the Latino community about using such a word, as many think that it's a devilish word. There is a big movement happening at the church of self-proclaimed prophet that gives a name that, of a man I'm not familiar with. He says he has a large church and tends to use the word supernatural. Many Latinos are against his teaching, and when they hear the word supernatural, they automatically associate with his movement. Well, in answer to your question, first of all, I don't know this man. I don't know his ministry. I don't know if his teaching is good or bad. As far as the use of the term supernatural, obviously the term supernatural can refer to bad things or good things. Miracles, for example, are supernatural in that they are not part of nature. They're not done through the processes of nature. They're done by a supernatural being named God. And there are also false miracles, which are done by the devil. Now, obviously, the term supernatural, it doesn't tell us whether we're talking about things done by one or another supernatural agent, but it's not a bad word in itself. It may be, however, that in some denominations, like the one you're talking about, they prefer simply use the word miraculous for things if they're of God, and the word supernatural for those which come from demonic powers. If so, then it's just a confusion about the word. And I always think that when people misunderstand a word, the pastors could very easily get up and explain what the meaning of the word is, if they themselves know. And I've never understood why pastors allow such confusion to continue in their churches unnecessarily, when they could simply say, hey, guys, the word supernatural doesn't necessarily mean demonic. Demonic things are supernatural, but so are God's miracles. So supernatural just means it's not natural. So I don't have any problem with using that term in the church, but if you're in a church where people automatically associate that term with the demonic, well, then I would suggest either using a different word or better, educate the congregation, tell them the word doesn't mean demonic. It's always better to educate the congregation up rather than dumb down. Because if you dumb down to the congregation, they'll stay dumb. And if you educate them up, they'll grow. They'll become wiser. Let's see if we can get Tom on the line here again. Tom, are you there?
Hello there, Steve. How are you?
You can hear me now?
I can.
Oh, it's good. Good. Excellent.
Good. I couldn't hear you at all before, and I figured, well, I'll just hang on the line, and sure enough, you came back. So good.
I'm glad you did. I think there's a technical problem in the studio. Go ahead.
Good deal. Hey, number one, if I could ask you, did you happen to get my email about doing the debate with Jimmy Akins?
I did, but I got it at a very busy time when I was traveling. I didn't get a chance to respond to you.
No problem.
Yeah, so, I'd be glad to.
All right, good. If you could respond to that, then I'll forward that down to him, and hopefully we get something going. That'd be great.
All right.
All righty. Hey, I'll ask my question and frame it, and then I'll go off the air so I can get busy on other things. I'm looking at the terms exegesis and eisegesis. Mm-hmm. And from what I understand, exegesis is more of a literal interpretation, the way the author meant it to be interpreted. And then the eisegesis is that person's own interpretation who's reading it. Is that kind of correct?
Not quite. Okay. The word exegesis, ex in Greek, means out of.
Okay.
And the preposition eis at the beginning of eisegesis, or ace, it means into. And what it means, exegesis, is when you read out of the text what the author intended. And eisegesis, or eisegesis, is when you read into the text something you want it to say. Now, the reason I disagree with your definition is because exegesis will not always yield a literal meaning. Because, obviously, if you're trying to get from the text what the author has in mind, you have to decide whether he's speaking literally or not. Is Jesus telling a parable or a true story here? You know, it makes a difference. Is the psalmist in the psalmist poetry, is he using literal language when he said that, you know, God formed the earth out of the sea with his hands like a potter makes out of clay? Or is that poetic? So exegesis doesn't always yield a literal approach. It just seeks to know the real meaning that was intended. And that requires, among other things, a recognition of the genre of a given passage. And sometimes that genre will be, we will see it as something to be taken literally. Other times it'll have some other proper way to be understood.
Let me ask you, would it be okay if the exegesis, if you're reading it, and it makes sense just in the way it's written, to take it in that form? Can it be interpreted a different way and say that you are still doing it in an exegesis way?
Well, some things could sound sensible literally, but they're not intended literally.
Okay.
I mean, if you'd say, you know, there must have been 50 cars in that pileup on the freeway. Well, probably there weren't actually 50. It's probably a hyperbole. But there could have been 50. So, in other words, it's something that could be taken literally. The question is, did the person who speaks intend it to be taken literally, or intend it to be taken as a hyperbole? That's something that would be important if you're trying to get the facts.
Right.
Important to figure out, are they using hyperbole or are they not? And so sometimes something that that is said, you could take it literally, and it might make sense to do so, but the context or something else about it will give you the impression that, oh, this is not being used in a strictly literal sense.
Right. Can I frame two scriptures, and then I'll go off the air and hear what your response on it is. A while back, you had a lady call in and was asking about that person confessed their sin, and Christ or God said, go and sin no more. Mm-hmm. And you said that you were thinking that probably was that particular sin that they had confessed, mm-hmm. And whether that would be exegesis or eisegesis. And then in Revelation 12:1, where we have debated before about the, I say that it's the mother of Jesus, and you say that it's Israel. So which one would be eisegesis or exegesis, or maybe they would be both be the same. So if I could get that, and then I'll listen for your call on the air.
Sure.
All right.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay, Tom. Thanks for your call. Yeah.
You bet.
Well, those passages, I would hope to use exegesis in both of them. But in some cases, the information that we would need to be certain about it, it may not be all available. When Jesus said, go and sin no more, in all likelihood, he's basically referring to the sin that had brought her into that trouble that she was in. And don't go do that again. Now, he could say, go and live a sinless life. And the words can certainly be literally understood that way. And Jesus would have every right to say that. But he didn't tell very many people to go out and live a sinless life, although we know that that is the thing that everyone should do. Jesus never in his sermon said, go live a sinless life. He taught what sin is, and he assumed that godly people are going to avoid sin as much as they can. But for him to say to a woman who already had shown great weakness morally, now from now on live a sinless life, it'd just be unusual. I'm going by my instincts here a little bit. I could be wrong. But I think he probably meant, don't do that anymore, what you did. I'm not condemning you for what you did, but don't keep doing it. This is what I think he's saying. Now, if you take it more that he's saying live a sinless life, you're welcome to do that, because I certainly urge people to live a sinless life too. I'm afraid that people who are told to do so might end up frustrated a lot, because there's no one who does live a sinless life. And so, and yet I do believe that we ought to encourage people not to sin. John said in 1 John chapter 2, verse 1, my little children, these things I write to you so that you don't sin. Yet if anyone does sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. So he says, I'm writing this so you don't sin, but I got a feeling you're probably going to. And so, to say don't sin is fine. And to mean don't ever sin would be fine. But I don't think that's necessarily the import of Jesus' statement in that particular case. But I could be wrong. And it really doesn't matter, because I'm not her, and I don't have to say, okay, what he said to her, I need to make sure I do. What I need to do is make sure I don't sin in the ways that I'm prone to sin. I'm not likely to commit adultery. That's not one of the things I've been strongly tempted to do. But there are other things I'm strongly tempted to do, and I need to beware of those. But in any case, I'm going to leave that one on the table for people to interpret however they prefer. I'm giving my judgment on it, and you might judge differently. As far as the passage in Revelation 12:1 about the woman who is pregnant, as a Roman Catholic, you believe that's Mary. And I'm not a Roman Catholic. I don't believe that's Mary. I believe that's Israel. And we both agree that the woman gave birth to Jesus. But you believe it's the actual individual woman in this case, because that's what the Catholic Church has taught. Although, by the way, the Catholic Church also teaches the same thing I do. I know because I wrote an article on actually this vision in Revelation 12 for the Christian Research Journal a year or so ago, and they asked me to cover the Catholic view on it. So I researched it and found out that, to my surprise, although I knew Catholics took this to be Mary, the majority of Catholic scholars that I consulted said it refers to the Church or the remnant of Israel, which is what I say, and secondarily, they said, to Mary. So I just don't add the secondarily part. And the reason is because in Revelation there are a number of women who are not literal women. There's a whore, a harlot, who represents Mystery Babylon, the mother of harlots. This is not a literal woman. There's also a bride who comes down from heaven, who's actually said to be a city, not a literal woman, the New Jerusalem. And so Revelation very commonly uses images, animals, dragons, women, men, and such things to represent larger concepts. And the woman in Revelation 12:1 is clothed in the sun with the moon under her feet and has a crown of 12 stars on her head. You only have to read the dream of Joseph in the 39th chapter of Genesis to know that that's a reference to Israel. So that's why I take it. Now, is that exegesis or eisegesis? It's exegesis, but it's not literal. See, you're assuming that exegesis means taking something literally. I said exegesis means drawing from the passage what is intended by the author. And when an author writes apocalyptic literature, it'd be a very rare thing for him to expect you to take it literally, since almost nothing in Revelation really yields a literal meaning. The devil's not literally a dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns. The ruler of the world is not literally an animal with 7 heads and 10 horns. Jesus is not literally a lamb with 7 eyes and 7 horns. These are the typical images in Revelation. They're not really literal. I mean, the harlot riding on the beast is not really a woman riding on an animal, and so forth. And the fact that the woman is also a city, both in the case of Babylon and the case of the New Jerusalem, the woman is also a city, I mean, obviously you can't take this literally, and it's very strange to take a woman image in the book of Revelation as an individual woman, a literal individual woman. That is not exegesis. That's just wooden literalism, and it's basically failing to see what the genre of literature is you're looking at, or how it's normally to be understood. Okay, Tom, I hope that's helpful. Daryl from Sacramento, California, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, Steve. Hi, Brother Steve.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good.
I got a question. Why do you prefer the New King James Bible over the King James Bible?
Well, I'm not sure I do. I like the King James Bible as much as the New King James. In fact, I used to use the King James in all my teaching, but I found that an increasing number of my students were illiterate, and they really had trouble with the King James. I never had any trouble with it because I was raised with it, just like I was raised in a bilingual home. I spoke modern English and King James English because I was raised around both. And an increasing number of young people who were my students over the years were not raised with that bilingualism. They didn't understand the Old English. Now, to my mind, the Old English is pretty easy to understand, and there's very few changes. I mean, all you have to do is tell people, you know, when you see the word thee or thou, that means you. Okay, got it? Good, we're good. But people still complained that the King James was hard to understand. And so I thought, well, I could be stubborn about this and say, well, I understand the King James. What's wrong with you people? Or I could say, well, maybe I should use a Bible encourage them to get Bibles that they can read and understand. And so I chose the New King James because it was so close in wording to the King James Version, although it's modernized the English. Now, of course, there are people who say we shouldn't use the King James or the New King James because neither of those use the Alexandrian text for the New Testament. And they feel like we should use the Alexandrian text instead of the Textus Receptus. That's an ongoing debate in the church. And, of course, those who don't use the Alexandrian text are in the minority now, and I'd be one of those. But I'm not, in using the New King James or the King James, I'm not saying that the Alexandrian text is inferior. I'm just saying there's not that much difference between them. If I read a New American Standard Version that uses the Alexandrian text, or I read the New King James, which uses the Textus Receptus, there's not going to be much more than a dime's worth of difference between them. And so, I mean, I take the passage, as far as the differences between the Textus Receptus and the Alexandrian text, I take those case by case. I don't assume that either text is always the superior text. I think I look at the changes case by case, and there's really not much there. Certainly nothing to worry about.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
Dale.
Have a
good day. Bye-bye.
You too. God bless you. Good talking to you. All right, Jason from Fairfield, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how you doing, brother? I would just like to say I heard one of your positions. This is a disagreement one here.
Okay.
I heard your position on women and leadership, and I used to actually hold your view with women on leadership that, you know, no women in leadership at all.
But I've never taken that view.
What's that?
I've never taken that view, but go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay, let me explain. So you have 1 Timothy 2, correct, that talks about this.
Uh-huh.
What I believe is going on there, and then I'm going to have my quick argument, and then you can rebut. I think Paul in 1 Timothy 2 is talking in generalities. What I believe is that generally men should run the church, but there are times when God calls a woman to do it or to be an elder in the church. Okay, and let me explain why. If you read, because I can read Greek, the original Koine Greek, it seems that he's talking in generalities here. In verse 15, he talks about how a woman will be saved through childbearing. That's the Greek word. The root of it is soso, which is you know, salvation, and that's the ongoing process of salvation. It's not talking about initial salvation, correct? So. And she'll be saved through childbearing. Now, we know Paul doesn't think that every single woman is going to have a child. This is a general thing that women, obviously, they're the only ones that can have children, and they're the only ones that can have children, and they're the best at raising them. So he has the women generally having children and then raising them. And then if you go to Judges 4 with Deborah, she is doing what Paul says not to do in Judges 4 with she's a prophetess. She judges Israel at the time. That means she uses the law of Moses to judge between, you know, a situation. She's teaching, obviously. She's having authority over men. She summons Barack, who is one of the, you know, the military leaders. So she's on par with Samuel. So this is a woman that obviously is doing what Paul says not to do in 1 Timothy 2, you see. And so, and then there's a lot of other things, like with Mary and the women coming from the tomb, but that's another thing. But I this Judges 4 really was kind of a thorn in my side with 1 Timothy 2 in having that as an absolute command, because you would have to say God was wrong to call Deborah here as a prophetess. She's a judge. She's using the law of Moses to teach men and to judge them.
Okay.
She's summoning people.
Now, before I run out of time, I've got a break coming up here.
That's my argument
okay.
on that. A lot more, but I'd like to hear your rebuttal. And I'd like to just stay on because I'm not on,
sure.
I'm just on the phone. I'm not
sure.
on the radio. So.
Okay. I will do that. First of all, you misrepresent my position. I've never said that women can't be in any position of authority. And I believe that when Paul said he didn't let a woman teach or have authority over a man, that he was talking specifically about the position of eldership, which is only one of scores of different ministry options. I mean, Paul did, of course, say that an elder should be the husband of one wife, which makes it sound like he wants them to be males. But that doesn't mean he wouldn't let women be leaders in any other capacity. There's lots of leaders. Paul was not an elder of a church, but he was a leader. Timothy was not an elder of a church, but he was a leader. So you don't have to be an elder to have some kind of leadership. I believe that in 1 Timothy 2 and 3, Paul is talking about elders, the appointment of elders and what their qualifications are. And I think Paul's saying that he doesn't put women in that particular position. But he's very clear that he believes in women prophets. In the 1 Corinthians chapter 11, he says that a woman can pray or prophesy if her head is covered, and that a man can only pray or prophesy if his head's not covered, he says. But it's clear that Paul lets women prophesy. In fact, Paul stayed in the home of Philip for a while, whose four daughters were all prophetesses. Paul never had a problem with women who were prophetesses. Deborah was a prophetess, and she spoke to Barak and said, you know, the Lord is saying that you should go out and deliver the people. Now, a prophetess can speak to a man for God just like a prophet can. This is not being the elder of a church. Deborah was not an elder of a church. She was an authority of sorts, clearly. She judged Israel. She was a prophetess. Whether Paul would have had any problem with that or not, people might differ, but I don't think he would have had a problem with it. I think Paul accepted the Old Testament as inspired and believed that God had raised up Deborah, but not to be the elder of a church. And when Paul's talking about the eldership of churches, he's talking about a very specific kind of ministry that he's got a certain kind of person in mind for. Women can be deaconesses or prophetesses or evangelists, lots of different things. The women at the tomb became evangelists. Angels commissioned them to do so. And now if you say, well, the instructions about this are not for every woman because Paul wants them to be mothers, and not all women can be mothers. If Paul's reason for not having women be elders was simply because he wanted them all to have babies, then you'd have a good case. But when he says he doesn't let women in that position, he doesn't give as his reason that women should have babies instead. He does say that he thinks women will be saved in childbearing and so forth, and I agree with you, that's talking about the process, not the events of salvation. But the reason he gives for them not being elders is not that they should be mothers. The reason he gives is that God made Adam first and made Eve to be the helper, and that the woman also, when she did take the lead in the Garden of Eden, was instrumental in the fall. Now, whether that makes a good argument against women being elders or not, people may have their own opinions, but that's the reason Paul gives, and therefore he's not giving something that is general with exceptions. There's no exception to that history. God only made man once and woman once, and there was only one fall. And it's the basis of that that Paul says he doesn't put women in that position. So I'm glad to hear your arguments. I don't find those to be exactly on target. And honestly, I think you missed my point, because I've never said women shouldn't be in any leadership. I believe that someone asked me if women should be pastors. Well, they didn't have pastors such as we think of them in biblical times, but they had elders who were told to pastor the church. And the question was specifically, can a woman pastor a church according to the Bible? Well, the only thing the Bible says about that particular question is no. So, you know, I don't write the Bible. I just teach it. I you know, if I was writing the Bible, I might put in some different things. But I have to teach what's actually there. And I have to find out the reasons, if they're available, why Paul said what he did, so I can see if they still apply. Well, that man was made first and woman was made second and woman took the lead in the transgression, that's still true as much as it was in Paul's day. And if that's the reason that he didn't put women in eldership, then I'm going to have to say that reason still seems to pertain. Anyway, I do appreciate you calling, and I hope I gave you enough time to make your point, because I think it was worth making, and I appreciate you doing so. All right, we're going to take a break here and come back for more calls. We have some stations that drop the program at the half-hour point and don't carry the second half-hour. For those listening to a station that does that, we want you to know you can hear the whole program from our website, thenarrowpath.com. We stream the program and we archive them for later. You can listen to them for free. You can also get for free the mobile app, thenarrowpath.com, for Android or for iPhones, and you can hear the programs on the app. The Narrow Path is listener-supported. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or from our website, thenarrowpath.com. Stay tuned for 30 seconds, and we'll be right back.
Small is the gate, and narrow is the path that leads to life. Welcome to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you. When the radio show is over, go to thenarrowpath.com, where you can study, learn, and enjoy with free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. See you at thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your phone calls. If you'd like to be on the program, I must say it looks like all of our lines are full at the moment. And so if you call right now, you're going to get a busy signal, I think. But in a few minutes, lines will open up, and you may want to have this number on hand to access our phone banks at that time. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. All right, our next caller in line today is Art from South Bay, California. That's L.A. Hi, Art.
Hi, good afternoon, Steve. Thank you again for taking my call. My question today is like this. You know, we hear so many people really want to know the nitty-gritty of the translation. But here's my question to you, what you think about it. I think in the Bible, there are two times when they use the word bold. But I have experience, I travel basically all over the place in the world, and what I found out, I don't know what your experience on that, when we really sit down with Christians, that's very rarely that a conversation will come up, you know, about how we ought to behave in the name of Christ. You know, there seems to be a certain curtain between, especially Christians, not me though. I love to talk about wherever I am. You know, hopefully I can.
Okay. So what's the question?
My question is what you have experienced and what I always have experienced with people, not really telling one another, hey, listen, stand bold and talk about God. And how come that is not being done? What is the reason you think? I pretty well know what the reason is, obviously, because when I listen to your listeners, and, you know, they seem to be try to be constantly politically correct, and hopefully they find an answer that suits them rather than find, you know, an answer that's God's way of saying things, whether they like it or not.
Well, I don't know that characterizes the callers here. I think there's some people who are, you can't always tell, but I think that there's a certain percentage of Christians that are bold in public to speak their views, and some are less bold. And, you know, if they are not so bold, and if the reason is because they're cowards and they're ashamed of Christ and they don't want to be persecuted for Christ's sake, then this is a defect, and they should repent of that and seek to be more forthright and less cowardly. There are other kinds of people who are not cowardly, but they're just not their temperament is different. They're not outspoken in public situations about anything. If they even if they weren't Christians, they'd be rather quiet in public settings because that's their temperament. They're just not that talkative. And such people, when they're Christians, sometimes will not be as outspoken for the Lord, not because they're ashamed of Him, but because it's not real natural for them to speak up in a group. And as I say, it's not anything about Christ that they're ashamed of, but it's just they're not the type to really speak up a lot. Now, some people who are rather shy and don't speak up boldly before they're Christians about anything become very bold when they become Christians. But, if bold means courageous, if bold means not cowardly, then I think this term could apply to anybody who will stand for their beliefs in the face of opposition, whether they speak up a lot or not. A person may not be very outspoken, but when it comes down to doing what's right, even when it's going to maybe lead to ostracism, they'll do it. And that's bold, too. And boldness isn't always found in speaking, but in living. And those would be thoughts I have. I can't answer for everybody who is not as bold as you mentioned that you think they should be. And each one probably has his own reason. And probably some of them are cowardly. And I think maybe that's what you're suggesting. Others, I wouldn't put it on cowardice. I would just say it's probably their temperament. So it could go many different directions. You'd have to take it case by case. All right, let's talk to Scott from Fort Wayne, Indiana. Scott, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is in reference to a call I heard you take on Friday, maybe. You said you contrasted what you called, I think, an Americanized gospel that uh-huh. we get today as compared to, I think you said, the gospel that the apostles taught, or that was taught in the New Testament. And that kind of piqued my interest, and I wondered if you could elaborate on that, what you think that the difference is between those.
Sure. Well, I think the gospel in modern times in the West has been tailored to the consumeristic culture and from the desire to sell Christianity, not for money, of course, but to sell it, in terms of persuade people to sign on, the same way that we'd sell a product. And that is to say, you need this, you'll be happier if you have it. This is, as all other things in your life are, this is all about you. This is about you getting out of hell and not going to hell. This is about you having all the best life now. In other words, it's a human-centered presentation. And in many cases, it gives the impression, and I don't know if preachers want to give the impression or not. I think some of them actually do, because I don't think they're thinking beyond this point themselves. Others may know better, but they're not aware of giving this impression. But people often get the impression from the way the gospel is preached in modern times that, the reason for Jesus coming was for me, was because I needed it, because I was in trouble, and because I'm pretty important and needed to be rescued. Now, there is some measure of truth in that. I am a person made in God's image. He does value me. Jesus did come and save me. But I believe the gospel in the Bible is preached from a God-centered point of view. It's not that it's all about me being saved. It's all about God restoring to himself something that he lost, like a sheep that had wandered away, and Jesus goes out and finds it and brings it back, or a coin that was lost, and he goes and seeks it until it's found, or a son that has left his home until the father receives him back. The gospel is God-centered. The idea is that God is the one who has lost something, and he wants it back. Now, what this means, then, is that when people understand the gospel properly, they are to understand that they are coming back to God on his terms for his sake. Now, is there anything in it for them? Absolutely. Absolutely. Being on good terms with God, in a good relationship with God, it's the way human beings were made to be. And so it's all good. Although when I say it's all good, there's persecution, there's hardship, there's trials, there's testing, there's a need to be loyal unto death if necessary. A lot of times people aren't, you know, that's not really featured in the headlines of gospel presentations these days. But sometimes people actually let people know about this. But the main thing is that there is a cost to it. And the reason it's worth it is not so much because of what I'm getting, although that is definitely worth it. It's definitely worth it to suffer in this life and be with God later on. But it's worth it because God deserves it. God owns us. God, we've been bought with a price. He made us. He bought us. He owns us. And we have wronged him by being sinners. And he needs. We need to come to a place where we're not interested. We don't want to wrong him anymore. That God is glorified in our lives. In other words, it's simply a focus on God. And when you read the preaching of the gospel in the book of Acts, if you read the recorded sermons of Paul or the recorded sermons of Peter, when they're speaking to non-Christian audiences and presenting the gospel, there's about three or four sermons of Peter like that, and there's about three or four of Paul's sermons like that. You'll find that they don't talk about heaven. They don't talk about hell. They don't talk about the things we talk about. They talk about Christ and his, position that God has given him, that God made him the ruler in spite of the fact that people crucified him. And in many cases, I mean, they don't sell Christ at all. They just proclaim that Christ is Lord, and they give some history of, you know, his life and his death and resurrection. And then they call people to repentance without making promises, without saying, hey, this will be much better for you. Do yourself a favor. This do yourself a favor attitude in evangelism is basically appealing to the self-centeredness that sinners always that always motivates sinners in choices that they make about anything. And so it's basically saying, just as you chose the car you drive, just as you chose the job you work at, just as you chose the neighborhood you live in because it suited your interests and your well-being, so you need to choose your religion that way. And Jesus is the one who can give you all the good stuff. That's all self-centered appeal. And when people, when people respond to a self-centered message, they don't repent of being self-centered. They remain self-centered. And that's why they remain carnal. That's why they remain resistant when they're told that they should give up their sin and live an obedient life. They don't understand that it's about that. They think it's about them getting their best life now. It's not about that. It's about God getting back what he deserves, what he made and what he purchased. And that's what Jesus came to do, is to purchase back for God a people who are zealous for good works. That's what the Bible says in Titus chapter 2. And that's how the gospel was preached in the Bible.
Okay, I get it. It's like it's our consumerist mentality,
yes,
in the West that we're, yeah. Okay, great. Thank you very much. That helps me a lot.
Okay, Scott. Appreciate your call. Thanks for calling today. Our next caller is Carol from Oakland, California. A lot of calls from California today. Hi, Carol. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. My question is, my grandson gave me a drawing, and it's a drawing of a dragon. And when I told a friend of mine about it, who is a very Christian person, she told me that in the Bible, Satan is depicted as a dragon, and that I should rethink keeping anything like that in my house. I wondered what your take on that was.
I think that sounds a little superstitious, for the simple reason that although it is true, Satan is depicted as a dragon in the book of Revelation, he's also depicted as a snake in some places. He's depicted as a lion in some places. He's like a roaring lion. Should we have no pictures of lions? And yet Jesus is also called the lion. So what are we going to do with that? You know, lions are bad or lions are good. I mean, so, you know, but to have the Bible use certain animals to depict God or Satan or Jesus. Jesus depicted as a lamb and as a lion in different places. It doesn't mean that those animals those animals bear a stigma upon them, because that happened to be the animal that was used for the illustration. I don't believe that Satan is a dragon. I believe that Satan is a spirit. A dragon is actually a mythical creature, or at the very best, a reptile, and Satan is neither. He is a spirit being. And that being so, we know that a dragon is just an animal image that is used in the drama of the Book of Revelation to represent Satan. But I don't believe that has to, mar all appreciation of art where dragons are depicted, unless the dragon is intended to represent Satan. Even then, should we not have a Bible in our house because it represents Satan as a dragon? I mean, you got a dragon in there. The real issue is, what's it for? Is it there to honor somehow dark powers? Or is it just a child's enjoyment of drawing a picture of an animal that he finds fascinating? I think that Christians can be too legalistic and too superstitious about such things. I've read books that say you shouldn't have frogs or dragons or snakes or anything like that depicted in stuffed animals or pictures or anything like that, because that's, demonic. I think this is superstition more than it is spirituality.
Wasn't Satan even described as he could be an angel of light and not to be deceived?
That's true, too. He appears as an angel of light. So, I mean, angels, the light angels would be a bad thing, too, then.
Right,
But not so.
Thank you. Thank you so much, because I know that, I'm not that strong yet, and I know that it just seems to me that some things border on superstition, so I just wanted some clarification.
And many Christians are somewhat superstitious in various ways, and that's something to grow out of.
And they're very fearful, like
she felt
that it could draw the demonic into my house kind of thing.
That's fear. That's a fear that we shouldn't have.
Right.
Now, we should be careful about things. I mean, if somebody gives you, like, a little idol or something like that as a house decoration, I do believe that idols do not belong in our houses.
Right, like a Buddha, or like somebody has a Buddha, they are a specific something that you worship.
Yeah, and although people don't usually worship Buddha, but, I mean, some do, I guess, things that represent or are intended to represent counterfeit spiritualities are things that I think are inappropriate in a Christian's home. But I don't think a picture of a dragon drawn by a child is necessarily inappropriate. I'm sure he didn't have Satan in mind when he drew it.
I agree. And I think the clarification that I'll take away is the intent of the object.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Okay, Carol.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
God bless. Okay, our next caller is Sam from Richmond, Virginia. Sam, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve, thanks for taking my call. You actually spoke in a Bible school I did in Kansas City a few months back. So really.
Oh, okay, I'm going there again in a few months. Yeah.
Oh, good. Hey, so my question is, I work in a ministry context to where we have a lot of young couples, a lot of young families kind of starting up. And one of the common questions we are kind of faced with is the idea of family planning. And the more I get into the gospel, the more I see, like you were talking about a couple of callers ago, about this selfless or this selfish gospel that we in the West so often proclaim, and is self-centered. And I find so much of, this conversation that people say they're not ready to have kids yet, they're not ready to have a family, they just want to enjoy their marriage and stuff like that. And I just don't see biblical support for that, and so it makes me a little uncomfortable. And I was wondering if you could just speak to your opinion on what the Bible says about family planning in any capacity.
Sure. Well, first of all, I mean, when people say that a young couple are not ready to have children yet, I'd say then they're probably not ready to get married yet. Because getting married and having children are both a piece of the same step that people take from being autonomous, independent, pretty much free to do whatever they want to do as single people, on the one hand, and moving into the establishment of a family unit, which begins with getting married and then follows with having children. Now, not everyone who gets married can have children, of course, but that's only because of the fall, and things in the, health issues are not what they once were before the fall. There are people who are barren. The Bible always considers that to be a sad thing, and one that people always are seeking to be cured of when they when it is the case. However, we live in a society where people make themselves intentionally barren, which obviously means they've got a real different mentality than people in the Bible had. Now, was the Bible mentality more godly, or is ours? Well, I understand the Bible to teach a number of things. One of them is that children are a blessing from God. In Psalm 127, it says they're like arrows in the hands of a mighty man. So are children, that are given to Christian godly parents. We are in a warfare here, and we need as many weapons against the enemy as we can. Our children are given to us to train up and to launch against the kingdom of darkness and to help expand the kingdom of God. Our children don't always end up doing that, and that's probably partly, maybe largely, our fault if we don't raise them properly. But the truth is, children are an asset. And the person who's not ready to have a child, you know what? The best way to get ready to have a child, in fact, the only way I know to get ready to have a child is to have one. I don't think anyone, until they have a child to be responsible for, is quite the same person that they will be when they have the child. I think having children changes you in a good way, or a bad way. If you're carnal and selfish and so forth, it can really, you know, be an unpleasant thing. But that's only because you're not thinking like a Christian. The Bible indicates having children is a blessing, and the person who has a lot of them is more blessed than the person who isn't. That's how the Old Testament seems to talk. Also, the Bible seems to say that God is sovereign over this kind of matter. God opens wombs and closes wombs. So as far as using family planning goes, I guess the question is, who has a better plan for the family than God? He knows how many children to give. You know, in my child-rearing years, my wife didn't use any birth control, and in 20 years' time, we had 4 children, and we wanted more. We wanted 12, or as many as the Lord would give, and we got as many as the Lord gave, 4 in 20 years. And we deliberately were seeking to have more. So, I mean, some people say, well, if you don't use birth control, you'll just be overrun with kids. Yeah, you might have, in your childbearing years, you might have 12 or 15 kids. Not very many people do. I know some people who have 10 and 11 children, and they did on purpose. But I mean, not everyone gets that blessing of 10 or 11 or 12 children. You get pretty much what God gives you. And so I never felt that using birth control had any use. All you're trying to do is limit blessings, and it's not really effective. God's going to open the womb when he wants to open it. I had a friend who had, there were 5 children in the family, and she said that her father, when speaking to them at the dinner table, said, you were the condom, you were the diaphragm, you were the pill, you were withdrawal. Each one was conceived while the parents were practicing a different type of birth control. And didn't seem to work. I even heard of a case on the radio a few years ago on the news of a couple where the man had had a vasectomy and the woman had had her tubes tied, and they got pregnant anyway. And they said that this was like one chance in 100 million or something like that this would happen. But apparently God wanted that baby to be conceived. So I've never felt like I cared to fight against God about that kind of thing. And also, I wanted more of blessings. There's not any other blessing I know of that people try to limit in their life. But you see, people do limit, or do their they attempt to limit their family size, usually because they don't see it God's way. They do see themselves as, you know, their freedom will be curtailed by having children. Yeah, it sure will. In fact, getting married curtails your freedom, too. In fact, just growing up and ceasing to be a child curtails your freedom. You take on responsibility. So I don't think it's a sin to use birth control. Well, let me put it this way. It might be. Some things are not sins in themselves, but they might be done for sinful reasons. Whatever is not of faith is sin. So while I don't think the Bible would name the use of birth control among the things that are sins, I would want to know if someone's saying, well, is it wrong for me to use it? I'd want to say, why do you want to use it? Your motivation might make it right or wrong. If a man says, well, my wife has been told she'll die if she has another baby, and so I've started using birth control out of deference to her, then that sounds like a loving thing to do. I would think that, you know, maybe another person in that position might choose to trust God in the situation, but I'm not going to make that judgment for them. I'm not going to say they're sinning. But At the same time, if they just say, well, we don't want our life interrupted because we've got a real freewheeling, prosperous life that would be interrupted by having children, I'd say, well, then using birth control in that kind of situation is not motivated very spiritually, and I would not think it commendable. So those would be my thoughts about that, Sam.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your call. Good talking to you. Okay, Walt from Turner, Oregon. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve.
Hi.
We had a couple of visitors the other night, and they suggested, they gave us a gift of a linen placemat, and they suggested that there's some healing properties in linen in the scripture. And I said, I've read it many times. I've never seen that. They said, well, you need to know the Hebrew or the Hebrew views on that. Do you know anything about that? I thought it was just a superstition myself, but I don't know.
It sounds like a superstition to me. I mean, linen is not mentioned very often in Scripture, but when it is, it's usually as the material for the priest's garments or for, you know, the curtains in the tabernacle or whatever. And there's certainly no magic or healing powers ever said to be in those. I can't even imagine what biblical passage they would be thinking of. And you know, it's a funny thing when you say, well, I can't think of anything in the Bible. Well, you have to know the Hebrew. The Hebrew of what? The Hebrew of what? What verse are you looking at, you know? I think sometimes people say you have to know the original language just because they can't defend their position, and they figure you don't know the original language, so probably they can get away with it. But, no, I think that's superstition. I can't imagine the Bible saying such a thing.
Okay, that's the way I thought. I just thought I'd better confirm my thoughts on that. Appreciate it.
Yeah, trust your instincts on that, bro.
Okay, thanks.
It's good to hear from you again. God bless you.
Bye now.
Bye now. That brother was a missionary in Africa with his late wife for many years, and I had the pleasure of meeting him some years ago at one of my meetings in Oregon, and he calls once in a while. Looks like we've got a Thomas. We don't have much time for Thomas, though. Thomas, can you do it in about a minute and a half?
Oh, all right. Well, I don't know if I can get it done and then, but I could try.
Try it.
Okay, thank you.
Time's ticking.
I'm sorry?
Time is ticking away. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have a question regarding women as elders, pastors, and teachers.
Uh-huh.
And I know you had addressed this earlier. The question I have is whether, for example, I've seen this happen also, elders may be a name for the function of a deaconess, somebody that ministers to the sick, et cetera. It may just be a question of the name. So a woman who's an elder in one church may not be the same as a woman who's an elder in another church.
True. That's probably true. In some churches, deacons are really the ones who are doing what in the Bible is an elder's work.
I see. Well, of course, maybe there's just too much for everybody to do. The other thing is regarding a teacher. We've had in our church occasions when someone would come with a teaching, a woman who, for example, and it's a delegated responsibility. I mean, you can think of a pastor, for example, having Corrie ten Boom teaching on forgiveness,
sure,
or Mother
Absolutely.
Teresa on serving the poor, or just somebody, you know, that's an ordinary person there who's extraordinarily good at expressing something.
Absolutely.
And in that case, the pastor is the one who makes sure that it's okay.
Right. I agree with you about that. And, I've never said that a woman can't teach a man in any setting. We know that Priscilla and Aquila, a married couple, taught a man, Apollos, and the Bible doesn't indicate that there's anything wrong with that. Paul, I think, in 1 Timothy 2 is simply saying that when women, when he refers to women teaching and having authority, I think he's simply talking about being an elder, and that's what he's forbidden. I would drive a long distance, and I did once, to go hear Elizabeth Elliott Grin, who's now deceased, but I think she's a wonderful teacher, and she wasn't a pastor, and she didn't believe women should be pastors either. She was against that. But she spoke to churches, and I was so glad she did. Listen, I'm out of time. I hope that's helpful. You've been listening to The Narrow Path.